So we're going to be beginning this evening our second mini-series, so welcome to our welcome to those who have been here previously, those who are joining. This particular topic is going to be looking, as you can see and as you have seen, the problem of punishment, and to really analyze together as a group sort of different theories of punishment within both the Torah as well as general philosophical sources, and to ask ourselves some hard questions, and questions that we don't necessarily think about, because very often criminal punishment for most of us, there are some people who happen to be certain Jewish professionals, of course, who deal with such things, but not all lawyers apparently right. necessarily deal with criminal law. My father is a case in point, my father-in-law is a case in point, two of my sisters-in-law and two of my brothers-in-law are all cases in point. So we have a very Jewish family, yes. It's an aspect, it's something that we don't necessarily think about, but as a social problem in America and well beyond America, this is a real challenge and a very difficult issue. Prison reform is something that's constantly being discussed among the political class, and there are always referendums, as we'll discuss, in California in particular. There's always a referendum in California. That's right. Always that's a universal. And one of the many referendums that they tend to vote on from time to time in California is on questions of prison reform. And so this is an issue that comes up from time to time. There are obviously financial aspects to this. There are sort of human rights or sort of sense of dignity dimensions to this. But there are sort of core questions that come up as part of these conversations that really go to the heart of the question, why is it that we punish criminals in society? And this is something that we'll see that has been discussed in the philosophical literature, but also certainly first and foremost in the Torah literature as well. We have a really interesting example we raised, I think, just before we took a break for the Chagim. We have something right here in Philadelphia. We have Eastern State Penitentiary, which I haven't yet had the opportunity to do the tour. It's a must do. Hoping to. Wanted to bring the students at one point. It didn't materialize, at least not yet. Logistically complicated, but essentially my understanding is, my impression is, that Eastern State Penitentiary was built originally with the intention of rehabilitating criminals through very intensive solitary confinement, basically, or something in that direction, essentially. And so the idea was that through this time of meditation, reflection, and loneliness, frankly, the criminals would have the opportunity to reconsider, to sort of rethink things, and emerge in society with a blank slate. It seems, my impression is, that that was not necessarily all that successful as an experiment. That essentially what happened is that instead of being rehabilitated, the criminals were not only criminal, they were also now traumatized for life. So they had all their criminal behaviors and inclinations, together with a whole host of problems associated with post-traumatic stress disorders, so PTSD. So that's my vague sense without having actually been there and done it. But you see that there was an attempt, and they actually reworked the purpose of the prison, and it was, if you go and visit, there are apparently later stages historically that are represented there, including Mod Shul, where the Jewish prisoners were able to pray. That was either after the time of solitary confinement, or it was via iPhone minion, I don't know. But be that as it may, it's one of two possibilities. But the question of why we punish and what are effective forms of punishment, but more to the point, really what is the very underlying purpose of punishment, is really an important question. It's also to ramifications. So let me open it up to you. Why do we punish criminals? Or obviously it doesn't have to be one right answer. If someone does something wrong, why do we, and there are all sorts of punishments, obviously, we can find someone, we can imprison them. In the Torah we have malchus, we have lashes, we have possibility of capital punishment, there's a whole range.
I think one reason is to purposefully inflict pain so that they would, perhaps not in quite a Pavlovian way, but they would associate pain with crime, mm-hmm. and therefore think twice, if not more, before mm-hmm. they do it.
That would be deterrence, right.
As a deterrent, but let's be precise.
To that person or everyone?
Both.
Good. So I hear Emily saying to the criminal, him or herself, And now I hear as well the possibility of it being a message to members of society. So sort of a double-edged deterrence. Absolutely. Now we just mentioned rehabilitation. That could be another purpose to punishment. Anything else that comes to mind?
Yeah, the sense of that you're meeting out justice.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
In whatever system of which you hope that justice would be.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Now, if I were to ask you, so there's a sort of an inherent, right? An inherent, I don't want to say maybe value or right. I mean the right in the modern sense, but I mean right in the sense of justice.
Right.
That the right, proper course is that if someone sins, that individual is deserving of some sort of onesh, some sort of punishment, and that's simply the right thing to do. Now, if I were to ask you to group some of these categories together, we have the notion of justice, just punishment, which is coming to that person. We have the notion of deterrence for that individual, for others, rehabilitation. Are there two of these theories that you think are more similar to one another, and one that is qualitatively different? How would you group them?
I think education and rehabilitation, mm-hmm. justice may all be together, and deterrence might be a different type
of
thing.
In what sense would deterrence be qualitatively different?
Deterrence has to be more than. Right? Because if you... I do commercial litigation. So if somebody steals $100 and you make them pay $100 back, that's just, right? You put them where they started. But that's not going to deter them because, really, they're not worse off. They might as well steal. Mm-hmm. So you have all sorts of, particularly like an antitrust law, you say treble damages. You pay three times mm-hmm. more because if you're going to steal, we're mm-hmm. going to take all those things you stole all year, so now there's a cost to you.
So you're saying if it's about deterrence, so that may manifest itself. The implication might be a much more far-reaching punishment sometimes than just that which is just in its own terms or meant to rehabilitate on its own.
That's right.
Okay.
Because it's not sufficient, mm-hmm. you know, just to put him back where he started.
Right.
For lots of people, that's not much of a risk.
Okay. Right. Any other associations?
Well, I would say to punish the guilty and to protect the innocent are two sides of basically usually the same coin. Mm-hmm. The social element, the 20th century social, even 19th century social element, is something relatively novel in human history. Mm-hmm. This the idea that we could change or make society better. Well, not novel. I could argue the Torah is trying to do it. But it's definitely something that wasn't talked about in criminal, as far as I know. I'm not an expert.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're only talked about making people better people and sending them back out into society.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was a whole new sort of stream.
I think that's generally assumed to be the case. Take a look at the history of it. 100%. If you think about the notion of rehabilitation, it strikes me certainly as a very modern kind of idea, right? In the sense that A, it's not the notion of justice as inherent is not there. It's not about, right? Well, we're going to use another term also as we go, retribution, sort of as in terms of the justice. It has a certain kind of overt, you know, or undertone to it. In other words,
is that like an eye for an eye?
So we're going to get to that. Yeah, that's on our source sheet. It's right there. 100%.
Like tshuva, like even Rambam's notion of tshuva is a very, it's a much older concept, really, of rehabilitation.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Mm-hmm. But it's 100%. Personal. How do you test that?
Good. So but is tshuva associated with punishment?
I mean, in a way, if you say you've done something really wrong, let's say,
mm-hmm.
really damage somebody,
mm-hmm.
and then you have to go through all these steps.
Right. Oh, the Rambam does describe this.
It's
true.
They are kind of a rehabilitation. If you really do them, it is kind of like
winding up with this
healthy rehabilitation.
You want to do it again. That awareness that you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
We think of teshuva, though, we think of like a self-inflicted kind of
okay.
internalization process as opposed to mm-hmm. something society
imposes upon you. That's what I was going to ask
right,
as well. Says shoot right the question, because that's what Nachum said, the notion that I'm going to sort of impose it on you,
right?
That's right. Sort of like sounds like nation building almost, right? Which we know has that.
That's also been under Rambam, teshuva,
right? Teshuva to feel a tzedakah,
because Rambam also brings up an amount of Navot, everyone pronounces his name, and the Bekamer vote, that's what loses off of his kingdom, because it's been under Machaber, and teshuva for that,
right?
the difference between Adam's sin and Cain's sin. The Pesachat Esrobe. It's like there's. So I think Ben Adam, I don't know if Teshuva works. Ben Adam Luchaberon is the essence of Mechila.
That's a very interesting point.
Certainly without the Mechila piece. Emily.
I think that Cain is a perfect example of that in the following sense. That first of all, God gives Adam and Eve the opportunity to atone when he says, why are you wearing why are you covering yourself? And if they would have said, oh, we're very sorry, but we ate from the wrong tree, and then we have this new, I mean, the forbidden tree, and then we have this new insight, and we really made a mistake. It seems to me that that was an opportunity for Teshuva that they missed. And with Cain, I was always struck by the fact that his punishment seems so suited to the crime, and that could possibly bring about rehabilitation. Let's say he didn't know that somebody so hard would bring death. But the main thing, some people have argued that, but not as the point is that
you're again, a nice person.
I'm saying theoretically, first he didn't listen to God. God tells him, there, you know, if the lion in the corner crouch above that image. But Cain says, am I my brother's keeper? So what is that? That's a disavowal of social responsibility. Okay, so you think that you don't have any social responsibility? Well, you wander around the world, and you see what it feels like when people don't take care of you, don't help to take care of you, because you're wearing this big sign.
Right.
So, and I know that Rashi reads the part about Cain, you know, having a wife and building a city or living in a city as before the whole thing. But actually, humbly, to me it actually makes more sense as after the punishment. Because, see,
now he understands what it's like to build a society. 100%. Well, if you would ask me which of the punishments we find in Torah sources sounds most rehabilitative, I would venture exile, galus. I think strikes me among the gamut of punishments as perhaps in that sense rehabilitative.
Because Cain is essentially exile.
As if he's the paradigm and the prototype for that. You could argue that, and there's something to that. And it goes to the Rambam also, who talks about the idea of self-imposed galus as part of the process of tshuva, and sort of the reinvention of a personality.
Could be. But it just occurs to me, since the Greeks have that, so many of the characters say Oedipus. What do they do when they realize that they've done a terrible thing? They exile themselves.
Right. And again, that's interesting, because that's, again, the self-imposed punishment. But punishment from the gods seems to be much more vengeance.
Yeah.
Right? I think in the Greek tragic. So, which
they're not
I think
a nice
might
group
be,
of people.
Which might reflect a more underlying difference in worldview, you might argue. So I think you see that this is a really rich conversation and opens up just ways of thinking about things. I think it just sort of, sometimes we think that there's certain topics, they're sort of well-trodden, we often think about them, we encounter them in all sorts of places, and so then we have new insights into those, but sort of the basic notion we're familiar with. This, I think, to me, is something not spoken about all that much. We kind of discussed this earlier. And so I think it's really interesting that it really opens up our eyes to all sorts of new ways of thinking about passages in the Torah or different kinds of things that we read about in current events or whatever it may be. So I think it really is, it's broadening in that sense. So what does the Torah have to say? Along the way, a number of Western sources as well. So we're going to start with that notion of justice or retribution. And perhaps the first source, even before we get to Ayin Tachas Ayin, I take a look at your source sheet number one, Parshat HaShavua, appropriately, Parshat Noach. Right? So Noach emerges from the Teva, God blesses him. Be fruitful, multiply. the fear and dread of you shall be right, and so on and so forth. And if you jump to pasuk vav, shofech dam ha'adam ba'adam demo yishafech ki betzelem elokim asa es ha'adam. So an individual who sheds the blood of another individual, right? This is actually a very difficult phrase. Chazal understands more, and Sanhedrin actually understands this as a reference to killing not only the person but the fetus as well. Shofech dam ha'adam ba'adam, someone who spills the blood of a person in a person. And so this becomes a crucial text for that. It's one of the ironies of halacha that a Gentile is liable, chayv misa in theory, in principle, for killing a fetus, but a Jew is not. Typically, it's always reversed, that the punishment for the Jew is, generally speaking, much more severe. And the Gemara even says in one place, how can you say that the Torah, which came to add to the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, would ever be more lenient than the punishment for a Gentile per se? But this is actually an ironic inversion of that principle. Discussion for another time. For our purposes, shofech adam ha'adam ba'adam damo yishafech. Right? So even on the literary level, you have the sense that, right, it's almost... Right. If you wanted to say it in a less sort of elevated way, you might say tit for tat. Right. That would be kind of what we'd think. Or in Chazal's parlance, we might say something like Mida Keneged Mida. Right. Isn't that a principle that seems to kind of go along these lines? Right. If it's got to be just. Right. Doesn't Mida Keneged Mida sounds like have that sort of sense of retribution, of justice in that way. And the reasoning, interesting enough, is because Bitzelem Elokim Asa Es Ha'adam, which I think is significant as well. But I think in particular this phraseology, Shafich Dam Ha'adam Adam Damoy Shafich, really speaks to this. And if you take a look at Radak, or David Kimchi, one of the classical Mefarshim, Al-Atar, right there in that place, I think he really highlights this idea. V'chein siva source to v'chein siva akel lishpoch dam ha'adam l'chet'o. Similarly, a Kadosh Baruch Hu commanded that we spill the blood of a person on the basis of his sin. Each person who is deserving of capital punishment in accordance with what that person deserves. Right, in proper measure. Why? You destroy God's tzelem elokim, right? The tzelem. So then, your tzelem, appropriately, as appropriate for each respective sin, is taken away from you. So there's really the sense of the concordance, that the punishment really fits the crime. Right? Again, when we use phrases like this, I think there's a resonance of this idea of the just meeting out of punishment, as Scott mentioned earlier.
But he's not saying that if you kill somebody, he's just saying if you sin against Hashem, that's sufficient for you to be killed. Is that the way, mm-hmm. is that correct?
Well, I think what he's suggesting here is that he's extending the meaning of the Pasuk to a larger range of cases. The Pasuk here just says that if I spill the blood of a person, my blood is spilled as well. What he's suggesting is that this is true not only in the case of someone who engages in murder, but also of someone who sins in a whole a gamut of other ways.
That's what I'm saying.
That is deserving of chiyuv misa, right? That ultimately incurs capital punishment. And the point is that since I, in that act of sinfulness, forfeited my tzelem elokim, so therefore, as a direct result, it's almost a consequence.
Right. It's been done. Right? We're just carrying it out.
All right. 100%. Now, something.
Wow, that's very
something that's really worth thinking about really closely, because raises the question, is just punishment, or if you want to call it retribution, is that the same as a consequence?
That's a very good question.
This is something, right? Let's just process that for a second. But very often we talk about something as a natural consequence, right?
Yeah.
So that's, of course, the word that you use in parenting nowadays. That's like all the rage. Right? There are no punishments, there are only consequences. You tell that to the kid. Right? That just sounded like a punishment to me. But there will be a consequence, young man. I just want to elaborate this a little bit. What does it mean when we talk about consequence? So there are examples of apparent punishments in Chumash and in Jewish history that we sometimes may think of as a consequence, right? The most classic example, forget in Judaism for just a moment, but just the most immediate consequence is a physical consequence, right? So, and that we would not call a punishment. So, for example, if I place my finger on the burning stovetop, so that's, right, so I burn my fingers, that's not a punishment, that's a natural consequence. But sometimes it shades into a punishment that is consequential in nature. For example, many have understood that Moshe Rabbeinu's inability to enter the land of Israel, to enter Canaan, and lead the Jews into the next generation was not so much a punishment because he hit the rock or something along those lines, but rather the point is the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu became so frustrated with the new generation and was not able to connect with them meant that he would not be the right person to lead the people into Israel. It's not necessarily a sin on the part of Moshe Rabbeinu. It's not a chid. It's just he's not the right person. Is it fully natural? I don't know. It's a consequence. It's not natural in the sense. It's not as direct as right. God could have still. It could have happened and just been.
Well, it also means
problematic. It might not have been so successful. Right.
Your point is he couldn't change. He had changed to an ineffectual leader.
At least
there was
for
no rehabilitation for him.
Possible. And so as a consequence of that, right? So again, but this is a form. Is it consequence? Is it punishment? Is that exactly the same as we're talking about justice? I don't think so, in the sense that you haven't done anything wrong. Our topic, I think, and you can define a topic however you want, that's just semantic, but when I think about punishment, I think about criminal in the sense that someone has done something sinful. Now, Moshe Rabbeinu may have made a mistake, he may have done something wrong even when he hit the rock. It seems pretty clear he certainly did the wrong thing. He didn't follow the word of the Kodesh Baruch Hu, and the Kodesh Baruch Hu castigates for him Moshe Rabbeinu sins, right? He erred, he was a chote. But the punishment isn't necessarily so much for the act of the chait, but rather for the fact that that revealed Moshe Rabbeinu's inability, or the ill fit between him and this new generation. So I think this raises kind of the question of where does a punishment, if I read the psukim alone, I kind of get the sense that it's really justice, it's retribution. Here it's almost in Radak, he's A, expanding it, and B, I think you're right, that it's almost more of a consequence, like it's done already, right? So like the Gemara says also similarly, that Titus came and was able to destroy the Beis HaMikdash, right? But essentially there was nothing there anymore in the spiritual sense. There was no Kedusha, it was long gone. And so therefore, when the Gemara describes in Yuma that he throws his spear into the Kodesh HaKadoshim, right, that's what the Paschal essentially communicates to him. So again, the idea that it was already done, right? We've already forfeited our Tzelem Elokim. So I think it's food for thought.
But one piece that a question there too is a warning. Right. Mm-hmm. So if it's a consequence, like mm-hmm. you're already there, the warning's not going to help you. Moshe,
right.
Even if Moshe was told,
mm-hmm.
he can't change.
Mm-hmm.
Versus if he could change,
right.
Would that have made a difference?
Right.
That's the rehabilitative
mm-hmm.
piece.
Can you?
And that's before anybody commits a sin, they're warned.
Mm-hmm. Right?
That's a requirement.
100%.
You
and
get that
sometimes
chance.
There are certain cases where it actually comes with a small step of punishment. We're going to talk about later the Vensora Remora, which is a very
right.
unusual case for
yes.
a whole range of reasons. But what's interesting is that it says V'yisruoto. They warn him, which Chazal understand, a warning by way of, according to most interpretations we've shown him, A, a verbal warning, and B, lashes. Even before you go all the way, which we're going to have to get to. But so you do have that, at least in one exceptional circumstance, even
you really
in
want
a corporal
to stop
sense.
Him from going there.
Because there already we're talking about an extreme scenario with very dramatic kinds of... So we'd want to
Although he's not
that.
So dramatic, it's the potential for what's... He hasn't even
well,
done anything yet. He's just like responding poorly to his parents.
We're going to get there. But what's interesting to me is that there the point is that he's young.
Very
and if the
young.
One is that he's young, then maybe he's malleable for less, you know, or...
Which is
right?
why everyone... No one's ever gotten it.
Right, right.
We don't actually ever impose
right.
it.
But there's the possibility, greater possibility for rehabilitation, perhaps. So I think that's an interesting point as well. So this is one example. Another example which we mentioned as well is in source number 3, the idea of ayin tachas ayin. Of course, not just ayin tachas ayin, it's a whole slew of different limbs that are substituted for another. In Vayikra Perachof Dalin, Parashat Amor, toward the very end of the Parsha, V'ishki kimum b'amisok ha'sher asa kemi asa lao. Right? Isn't that very simple? He would sell them, right? It's that, right?
it's
shofich dam adam, adam damo yishafich, right? Kasher asa kin yaseh lo. Shever tachat shever, right? So it's a break for a break. Ayin tachat ayin, eye for an eye, shin tachat shin, tooth, right? Kasher yitin mum ba'adam, kin yinatin bo. So again, it's that sense of tit for tat, right? And so on. Now, here's the question, though. Of course, Chazal understands that this is not literal, right? And the Gemara has all sorts of different drasho to try to explain. And we know that the bottom line is there was such a tradition, and Chazal, right? And Chazal tried to understand where exactly that came from in terms of understanding the psukim, in terms of the exegetical side of things. But it's very clear to Chazal that that's the case. So now the question is, okay, so the simple reading of the pasuk Ayin Tachazayin sounds much more literal, but does Chazal's interpretation undercut that? Because you're actually paying money, you're paying damages.
It's not the same,
right? You're paying maybe the hamisha dvarim. There are actually multiple ways in which you're responsible for chavala. If you physically mean another person, it's a whole parak and bavakama, parak hachovel, someone who wounds. You don't actually gouge out the guy's eye. So my question is, at first glance, Ayin Tachazayin is really retributive in that sense, but does Chazal's interpretation perhaps take away from that a little bit?
Definitely.
Because we're saying, well, we don't actually gouge out an eye for an eye. We don't take a tooth for a tooth. So maybe what they're saying is maybe it's not as, you know, this notion of the tit for tat isn't really what is meant to be conveyed.
It seems to me that this passage is about appropriateness. It's measure for measure, mm-hmm. not in a literal sense. I once saw a bumper sticker. I've come to think about bumper stickers and mugs as the Lahavdil Perkei Avot of American society.
Depending on the bumper sticker, you may have to add a couple of Lahavdils.
I said Lahavdil. It's an eye for an eye leaves you with two blind people. Something along those lines. That it's about as I said, appropriateness, measure for measure.
Mm-hmm.
So the money makes sense in that what is that person losing in terms of capability or earning, most importantly. Maybe there are also, you know, emotional damages, etc., etc. Mm-hmm. So the money seems like a fair thing.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other ways of creating appropriateness.
Mm-hmm.
And from what you said before regarding the Tzelem Elokim, in the secular world, at least the democratic secular world, we have an implicit social contract.
Mm-hmm.
So for punishing somebody and even killing somebody, theoretically speaking, we're not talking about the corruptions of the challenges of the legal system, but theoretically speaking, mm-hmm. if the legal system worked purely, no race, mm-hmm. no racial,
mm-hmm.
lawyer,
etc., etc.
Person, I don't mean
you. It's on the MP3 for eternity.
Oh God,
we have you.
Oh no,
your name's not solid.
It's okay. We don't know who it is. Don't say her name.
But person violates the social contract. Person loses attention of the social contract.
Again, it's sort of that's a consequence.
Yeah, so I don't know if that's consequence or justice. I wanted to ask.
Well, that's kind of that's what we were asked. That's kind of the point.
It's like kind of both. So I admit, which is very unpopular in academic, quote, liberal circles, theoretically, I believe in capital punishment. Right. I think that very cautiously with all sorts of...
But you're saying, but that doesn't always mean that in
theoretically,
practice...
Theoretically, yeah, you broke the social contract, depending on how heinously you broke the contract, you lose protection.
Right. Right. So,
but why didn't the Torah say...
Mm-hmm.
Torah does not use words mm-hmm. extra, which
right.
is Chazal's point mm-hmm. right here, that it was...
Right.
But when it wants to, it names 25 people
right.
by name.
Right. So I think it's a great question. I think that's what Emily is driving at, which is the Torah wants to suggest that even when we don't implement a literal eye for an eye, what we're trying to do is to find something that is truly equitable. As much as we can. And by the way, an eye for an eye is, and it's been pointed out, it's very hard for an eye to eye to necessarily be fully equitable, or a limb for a limb, and so on and
because
so forth.
The people themselves are different.
The people themselves are different, and you will use it in different ways, and all sorts of differences, and, you know, it's a righty left. You know, it gets ambidextrous. I mean, it's really interesting to think about. I'm much better with one eye. Two people who can only see out of one eye, they both have a disability, but it will impact those two people in different ways, potentially. And some will, you know, and some will... So this notion of literal is probably a human impossibility. There's only one entity that can probably accomplish that, and he's not the one deciding these matters here on Earth. So, you know, I think that's really... Either way, it has to be the essence of the matter and not... the literal. I think that's part of it.
So just thinking, this feels, just using your words before, this feels more like retribution and what we actually do. You know, if you blind someone, then you have to figure out how much money they're losing, and then it feels more like the consequence, like the natural consequence.
But why is that a natural consequence?
A consequence in the sense that you blinded someone, they can no longer work, so now you have to give them the money that they would normally need to pay for their food.
So it's more like a functional aspect to it, rather than
to make them whole.
This feels really like retribution. You did this is going to happen.
No, I hear.
So they do have a very different feel.
100%, right. Okay. So I think that's something that's worthwhile. I do want to point out there's I think a very striking passage from the Rav, and I'll just mention it in case you want to look back at it at any point. And I don't know if he meant it maybe only in a homiletical sense, and therefore it's not necessarily immediately relevant to our discussion, but because it's about an eye for an eye anyway, I figure it's worthwhile. So this is in Kol Dodi Dofek, which is the Rav's work, is really his approach to theodicy and in general the Holocaust in particular, the distinction between two types of covenant that the Jews have, the Brit Gorel and the Brit Yud, a sense of fate, shared fate, which is really not up to us, it's just something that binds all Jews, and a sense of destiny. The English translation is entitled Fate and Destiny. Highly recommended reading. It's absolutely gorgeous, and it's also inspirational because he describes these six knocks. He suggests that with the founding of the State of Israel, there were six knocks, heavenly knocks, upon our door. And it's our responsibility as part of our covenant of destiny with God to respond to these knocks and to be attentive and to act. And the Rav challenges us to ask ourselves the hard question, in each of these six cases, did we really answer the door? And so it's pretty remarkable. In that context, he discusses what he calls the fifth knock. He says, the fifth knock of the beloved is perhaps the most important of all. There's a, in the book, Kol Dodi Dofek, in English translation, this is on page 31. For the first time in the history of our exile, divine providence has discovered our enemies, has surprised our enemies, with the sensational discovery that Jewish blood is not free for the taking, is not hefker. If anti-Semites wish to describe this phenomenon as an eye for an eye, so be it. We will agree with them. If we wish, and this is just... The Rav is very direct. He doesn't bat an eyelash here. If we wish to heroically defend our national historical existence, we must at times interpret the verse an eye for an eye literally. How many times did we lose during the course of our bitter exile because we did not return blow for blow? The time has come for us to fulfill the law of an eye for an eye in its plain, simple sense. I'm certain that everyone who knows me knows that I am a believer in the oral law, and consequently, that I do not doubt that the verse refers to monetary compensation in accordance with the halachic interpretation. However, with regard to Nasser or the Mufti is the one who started the riots, pre-World War II riots, including in Hebron, massacre in Hebron, I think it was 1929, correct? 1929. So with regards to Nasser, the Mufti, I would demand that we interpret the phrase an eye for an eye in a strictly literal sense, as referring to the removal of the concrete, actual eye. so on and so forth. Now, the Rav was not a warmonger by any sense. He was not a violent person.
Sometimes it means what it means.
And that's pretty much his point.
So he would say sometimes.
Right?
That's consistent with what you're saying.
And that's interesting.
Sometimes you have to resort to this,
and we have to have it in there so that we remember.
Right. Now, that's the exceptional case, but unfortunately, you know,
look, remember
that wasn't always.
We were told that.
That's right.
And we say it every year.
Right.
So we don't forget. Not everybody, but those guys, you take them all.
If it need be, it is what it is. He says sometimes it's us or them.
Right.
You know? So this is unbelievable.
No,
of course you're
not.
I know you're not.
No, I love it.
I know
that.
Yeah.
I'm there.
I think it'll be interesting,
Nazi,
though, to if you.
Yeah,
that's what the Rav means. And this is a response to the Shoah. That's what this is.
Right.
Period. End of story.
Right.
It does make perfect sense. But I think it's interesting in this context in particular. Okay. Good.
But that's self-defense almost.
Yes.
He's not talking about it as punishment. He's really saying
survival.
And what do we have today? All the nations saying disproportionate response.
Yeah. There's no such thing as a disproportionate. If someone's killing you, you stop them. There's no response that's disproportionate. You're right. I know. I'm telling you. Oh, it makes me crazy.
Good. Now some others will listen. Okay.
Right.
Keep going on this one.
Anyone want to go to the UK Parliament? Because we're just preaching to the choir over here.
Right.
So you want to preach in the UK Parliament? Now that.
A different question.
Just come well protected. You mean curb punishment?
Until someday, yes.
Unfortunately. Unfortunately is right. Very frightening. Now, I just want to point out before we move on in these sources to just refer to an article that I was first exposed to as an undergraduate at Yeshiva University as a professor who actually taught here in Penn anyway, what was then known as Dropsy College. Dropsy College was at the time, it eventually turned into what's now the Penn Jewish Studies Center for Jewish Studies. And at the time, Dropsy was one of the, if not the, central university sort of epicenter for academic Jewish studies. Really, in particular, biblical studies, but beyond. But Bible especially, it was really just, it was a powerhouse of top-ranked, top-ranked scholars and so on and so forth. One of them was Moshe Greenberg. Moshe Greenberg was by no means an observant Jew, was, however, a deeply traditional Jew. And what he did was he used certain aspects of modern biblical studies to, in particular, he was interested in comparative literature. So he did a lot of the pioneering work on the comparisons between Parsha Mishpatim and Jewish civil law on the one hand, and the Code of Hammurabi on the other, and these kinds of things. And he has an article in which he actually compares between and contrasts, is really his point, between the Code of Hammurabi and Parsha Mishpatim, essentially on matters of civil law. And I'll share with you his basic thesis. Basically what he says is that although on the surface there are many similarities, there is a core difference between these two systems of law, if we examine Hammurabi on the one hand and the Torah on the other, really carefully. He says essentially, not just in Hammurabi, but in other ancient Near Eastern contemporaneous law codes, it was extremely common for one of two things to happen. Number one, for there to be a capital punishment for a monetary crime. So if I steal enough money, I might be put to death. And vice versa, it's possible for me to have to pay you money for engaging in murder or manslaughter or something along the spectrum of some sort of blood money, in fact. Now, if you take a look at the Torah, that's not the case. It's crystal clear for sure that if a person engages in monetary criminal activity, right? So white-collar crime is severely censured, and unfortunately sometimes We haven't always heard about the importance or the consistency in terms of our commitment to this area, but it goes without saying that in the Torah it's exceedingly important. But the punishment, or and the punishment, is monitor is going to be monetary in nature, will never be corporal, and certainly never going to be capital in its nature. And the inverse is true as well. Certainly that's how Chumash is generally understood, and Chazal understood it, that that I'm not going to have to pay money for actually killing my fellow Jew or a fellow human being. And he makes a big deal out of this point, because really in this respect, the Torah is qualitatively different than many, if not all, of the contemporaneous law codes that certainly Professor Greenberg was familiar with when he was studying this matter. And his conclusion is, sort of the point is, that this is not just a coincidence, but this is an ethical principle. It's really a principled matter on the part of the Torah, and the Torah is intentionally moving away from its contemporaries and saying, no, that mixing of realms is unethical from a Torah perspective. There are two domains of punishment, and they need to be kept separate. And to intermingle or mix the two is inherently problematic. It's essentially Professor Greenberg's thesis, which it struck me at the time, and it still strikes me now in this context, well, different context, I wasn't thinking about these issues then, but it strikes me now as being very interesting for this discussion, because essentially what that is saying is that this is basically a notion of justice. I think that's the idea. And justice dictates sort of what we call the right punishment, would teach us, would indicate, lead us to the conclusion that these are two totally separate realms and they can never the twin shall mix. And that's an ethical, principled, moral matter. And so again, the notion that if our punishment is about that which is just and that which is right inherently, so then obviously there are going to be particularly strong moral principles that govern how it is that we punish. Now, for example, from a deterrence perspective, this becomes a little bit iffy.
Right.
I mean,
you can't punish someone more.
Right. No, well,
right.
On the deterrence argument, as you said earlier,
you could. No, for deterrence you could, but if it's injustice.
Right, correct, exactly.
You're limited.
From a deterrence perspective, in theory, I'm not saying you have to say this, because there obviously could be, right, we could be simplifying the matter here, there could be ethical, moral limits to how far we'll go in the name of deterrence. Right,
you could punish someone who's
but
completely
in
innocent.
Theory, right? That's going to be one argument we're going to have to see. Right? Might not be punishment in that sense, right? Or
certainly not deserving of it.
Right? Correct, 100%. And number two, you might go much further, and maybe you'd even cross that line. And if a person is right, if society is literally crumbling because people are stealing, I don't know. Maybe I
choose a guy.
That's unreasonable.
Do something bad to him.
Okay, and
steal.
You know, you won't have your problem anymore.
We have a living example, Madoff.
Right.
I mean, the institutions, not to mention the private lives that he ruined.
Right.
It was about money. He didn't kill anybody, but.
You're saying you could have imagined a society that would have implemented capital punishment for a Ponzi scheme of $50 billion.
Even as I'm saying it, I don't feel in my gut. I'm just talking about guts.
Right.
That he should be killed, but
no.
Boy should have. Life, you know, 100 life sentences.
Yeah, that's the thing with the 100 life sentences,
yeah,
you know.
I can only have one life in jail.
Cats can have a couple.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's a pretty severe punishment for
right.
money.
But again, it's taken for granted that, but we know that there's a limit. In other words, no one would ever conceive, right? Imagine the notion of someone advocating for a law in a particular state in which we suggested that, right? Even in the aftermath of Madoff, no one would have ever conceived of such a notion.
The only penalty is Jewish law. We have people can have criminal penalties as well as paying. But the paying is like suspended. You go on the principle. You have like two penalties imposed.
If the notion of you have the,
like they're still imposed that penalty, but it's not. I'm saying that you still receive that penalty.
Oh, I see.
You're still imposed that penalty, but it's not received because of that other principle.
It's superseded. Right. So there's the notion of Kim Leib Derabamina. Right? So Kim Leib Derabamina basically teaches that in certain circumstances, if I incur two penalties simultaneously, including, for example, a corporal punishment and a financial punishment, so the greater one outweighs or overshadows somehow the other, and I only get the greater of the punishments. There is such a principle. There are many blot and gemara that discuss its the scope and where it applies and so on and so forth. But yeah, that's an important principle.
Thing of realms. At least in theory, because in actuality we don't carry it out.
Right.
Which is interesting.
Right.
I don't know if that's discussed that way.
Right.
But that's
a little bit different, because what we're... First of all, that... Here, I think we're talking about especially capital punishment, just to make that point, but also, I think there, what we're suggesting is, you still were deserving of two separate punishments. The question is, do we implement both? So it is talking about the overlap between them, but you were still deserving of both. We're not saying that for an action which falls under one domain, you get punishment on the other side. You would actually be chayav misa, so it'd be different. Okay. Just to now move toward alternative theories of punishment in the Torah. So certainly we find, it would seem that we find others as well. Take a look at source number 4. We won't read the entire section, but this is the parsha of the Mesis. Okay, this appears in Varim Perek Yogimel, in Parshas Re'eh. The Mesis is someone who, in the classic case, seduces another individual to idolatry, to idolatrous worship. What the Ir HaNidachas is, the idolatrous city, is to an entire community or an entire city, this is to an individual. I seduce one person or a small group of people to worship a pagan god. What is the punishment? So you can jump down already to Pasuk Yud Aleph. Uskaltova avanim bames. So what do you do? You stone the person, right? That person is put to death. Kivikesh, why? Kivikesh adi chacham yal Hashem elokecha amotzeicham yeretz v'tzorim mitav adim. He sought to pull you away, to cause you to stray from your commitment to God who took you out of Egypt. And what is the goal? Or maybe an additional goal, let's think about this. Pasuk Yud Beis, V'chol Yisrael Yishmeru V'yiraun, all of the Jewish people shall hear and shall fear. V'lo Yisiv L'asos K'davar HaRazah B'kirbecham, they will not continue to act in this evil way in your midst. Okay? So what do we see certainly in that closing verse? Right? You have the idea of deterrence, in particular deterrence for others, right? Other people, call Yisrael, Yishmuv Yiron, Beleosiv Elasos, and so on and so forth. So clear cut case of deterrence in Chumash, in the case of the Mesis, and the Ramban picks up on this. The Ramban is a longer piece, well worth reading the whole piece. We'll just pick out a snippet that's most relevant, right there on the spot, in Dvarim Perchof Aleph Pasuk. Sorry, it's not there, it's in a different context, so I'll explain in a second. This is in context of Edim Zomine, the false witnesses. So the Ramban there writes, "V'zeh tam v'chol Yisrael yishmu v'yirau." This is the reasoning, or a really tam often is used in the sense of an explanation. Just as a sidebar, very often when we hear the word tam in Hebrew, usually we interpret that as a reason, which is what I just slipped and did now. If you take a look at the Mefarshim on the Torah, you look at the Rishonim in particular, Ibn Ezra, Ramban, others as well, they very often use the term ta'am, not as a reason, but rather an explanation. Which, right? It's not the reason the Torah says X, or the reason this person is punished is because X. It actually means is, this is the rendering, this is the meaning of this phrase in the Torah. So just... if you're reading with Farshim, just an FYI, worthwhile skill, little point to have in mind. But that time, this is the meaning of the phrase "V'chol Yisrael Yishmu V'yirau," which the Torah uses in context of the witnesses as well. The Yom Zomim Kilohu Mas V'Godel Chetao. Because in this case, the case of the Yodim Zomimim, as the Ramban goes on to say, it's true for the Mesis and a few other instances as well, this individual was not killed due to the greatness of that sin. Ella, rather, explicit in the Ramban, liaser bo'et harabim, to warn the public. Right? It's a deterrent. V'shelo yihyeh takala la'acherem, and so that this person should not be a stumbling block for others. Perhaps the point is that not only will this, right, will everyone learn, oh, this is unacceptable, I've crossed the red line, it's unacceptable behavior in this particular society, but also that this individual will now no longer be able to sway others to act in such a sinful fashion. So clearly there are a number of instances, at least four, some of these cases. It's these two. It's the Edim Zomim. It's the Nasis, Mediach, the seducer. It's the Ir HaNidachas, and it's the idolatrous city, and it's the Zakin Mamre is the fourth case. The Zakin Mamre is the rebellious elder who rules against the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin comes up with a particular ruling. It's codified. It's publicized as a formal ruling of the governing body of all of Klal Yisrael, and this individual essentially rebels by ruling in contradiction of the Sanhedrin. Now, inherently, it's true that's an act of rebellion, but the truth is the person might have the best of intentions. Now, I'm a scholar. This is a first-rate scholar. It might be a member of the Sanhedrin. In fact, it might need to be a member of the Sanhedrin. I'm just doing what I think is right. I'm standing by my sense of integrity, right? This is intellectual honesty at its best. And yet the person is punished, actually, potentially, with capital punishment. And the point is that this is not, again, because of the inherent sinfulness or justice of the act, but because of the ramifications for the system. If you have someone who's allowed to entice others to sin and they're allowed to continue to go around doing that, what does that mean for the future of our commitment to our laws and to our God? Right? If people are able to walk around testifying falsely and getting away with it, what does that mean for the integrity of our legal system? And the same thing for someone, if someone is able to contravene the law of the highest court of the land, if someone can come along and say, just a judge can go along and say, Supreme Court justice, right? Supreme Court ruled on this issue, that's very nice, I don't accept the authority of the Supreme Court and I'll continue to rule against them, right? So that undermines the entire fabric, the basis of the judicial system.
Don't
usually kill those persons. So again, in this case, as in many other cases, the practical ability to put the person to death is limited. There's a warning of all sorts of different things that are in place, so that the actual manifestation, putting this person to death, is exceedingly difficult to actually do in practice, I think, intentionally so. But I think, again, there's an underlying principle that's meant to be taught here in terms of the potential danger of someone who goes that far.
But then the gravity of this, but my question is, but then the gravity of the sin is gravity. So what you're saying is the sin is very grave. It undermines the system. It's not only the action, but the action is itself in context is very grave. What it's different to me than what Ramban is saying, which is it's not such a bad sin, but we're going to punish him more, which is what deterrence is. We're going to punish him beyond what he deserves so others don't do this. But that's not really what you're saying.
But why would you punish him in this case so that others won't do this if it's not such a big deal if they do it?
I think take theft, right? Or, right, you want to, it's not such a big deal, but it would be a breakdown in society.
I'm just saying the two explanations that we're offering are sort of, I think they're coming a little bit closer. Because you're saying, what I'm saying is, well, it's, right, you're suggesting, I'm saying that it's terrible because
the sin is really great.
If you're saying, well, it's going to lead them all to violate a sin which itself is really great. I guess they're different.
Isn't that in and of itself a...
Okay.
Because he's already done that.
Fair enough. Okay, so maybe they're unbound.
There's no room for minority
opinion. There is, except that at a certain point that the law is codified and... you know, and enforced for all of the for the entire nation. At that point, intellectually, you can think whatever you want, and you're encouraged to think so. But you can't actually go out and recommend that people violate the law of the land.
So
that's really the idea. Yeah, it is. Very much so.
We have our minority opinions.
No, Kitzel's just saying we don't put you to death.
We don't put them to death.
That's the only difference. Other than that, it's the same thing.
Right. We don't like it. It happens all the time.
Right.
And then the Court of Appeals will overrule it.
Correct.
And say, you judge 100%. Haven't been following the law. Yeah. And in an extreme case, they get removed from the bench. But that's so extreme.
Right.
They don't get, like, removed and shot.
Right. Well, then we talk about lifetime appointments and whether or not that's really the best thing for this.
That's right.
It's another conversation. Okay, good. We're going to pause here for this evening. God willing, next week we'll continue the conversation. We're going to continue a little bit with another critical source for deterrence. This is an individual in Germany in the 17th century who drank Gentile wine, which is considered to be a significant prohibition, and there was a rabbinical authority who had recommended that this individual not be harshly punished. Because if you punish this person too harshly, then the person might just go further. You're just going to cause them. And the Chavot Ya'ir of Ya'ir Bachrach, who was the chief rabbi of Worms and local communities in the 17th century, one of the great Gedolei HaDor at that time, he actually pushes back against that local rabbi. He overrules the rabbi, the chief rabbi. Not only overrules, but essentially is extremely dismissive of the ruling of the local rabbi and says, that's very nice, but we have an entire community to worry about. And so therefore, throw the book at him for the sake of deterrence. So we're going to see this response, which is a very interesting sort of pitting of two rabbinic philosophies against one another. And then we're going to take it from there. We'll take a look at that point, we're then going to look at philosophers and thinkers who push back against both of the theories that we've examined so far. Retribution on the one hand, and deterrence on the other, critiques of each, and then we'll move forward with a few other theories that we had mentioned earlier. So that's going to be the plan. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you very much.